This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. At the state capitol, there is a preliminary report which finds that two state lawmakers misused state taxpayer resources in an effort to conceal their extramarital affair. But there is not a deal for a long-term road funding deal. State Representative John Hoadley's here. The Democrat represents the city of Kalamazoo and some surrounding townships in the 60th State House District. John Hoadley, thank you for being here.
Well, howdy. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with the scandal. We're speaking on Tuesday, so yesterday we got the preliminary finding of the misuse of state resources in order to conceal this affair between Representative Cindy Gamrat of Plainwell and Todd Corser, who represents the Lapeer area. Based on what you know right now, is it plausible that the State House will begin some sort of expulsion hearings for these two representatives?
Well, Gordon, you know, we start by having not seen the report. So we have some headlines, but until we have a chance to look at it, you know, I'd be hesitant to comment on it too much. But that said, you know, this is going to be then one piece of evidence that will form, go into the committee that looks at their ability and fitness to serve. That's going to be a bipartisan committee. And that group will then be charged with figuring out, you know, is there evidence here that warrants some sort of further disciplinary action? And that could be a censure, that could be no action, or could be a recommendation for expulsion.
What in your mind have you gotten there yet of what rises to the level of an expellable offense?
I do think we need to be careful here. And, you know, I do think we also have an obligation to make sure that people are upholding their oath to the state constitution and our federal constitution and the people that they serve. It's important, though, that we're making sure that something potentially criminal happened here or a significantly reprehensible or misuse of state dollars and state resources. You know, hypocrisy itself is not an expellable offense. And ultimately, I'm very hesitant, and I think other folks are as well, to overturn the will of the voters, you know, just for either a cheap political shot or political expediency. And we have to be really careful when we tell the folks of the 80th district, or I think it's the 82nd district, you know, that their decision to elect these representatives should now be overturned by a small group of people in the state legislature. Ultimately, you know, if there was a concern here, we used to have a more robust recall process that would have been appropriate for this. But the Republican legislature changed those rules a couple of years ago, which, you know, ultimately we now may be reaping what we've sown.
But do you rule out the possibility that you could see something in this report that jumps out at you and makes you say enough, one or both of these lawmakers has to be expelled? Are you open to that possibility?
I'm absolutely open to that possibility. And I do take seriously our responsibility to police the behavior of the chamber. And that is one of the duties laid out in the state constitution, which I took an oath to uphold. So I will do that to the best of my abilities.
One more thing I want to ask about the scandal before we move on to some other things, and that is the fact that it involves these two lawmakers who have been very outspoken on the idea that we should not have gay marriage. On the day that the Supreme Court handed down its decision legalizing gay marriage in the United States, Representative Corser called it an absolute tragedy for our nation and its future. Representative Gamrat said that now more than ever, Christians and those who do not embrace the homosexual lifestyle will need protections legally. As one of two openly gay members of the Michigan House, when you hear those statements and then see the behavior, which we know was going on either at the time or prior to this, what is your reaction to that?
You know, I appreciate that they're entitled to their opinions and that for them, they've held these values very closely. Obviously, I disagree. I don't think we have the same biblical interpretations. You know, the God that they speak of is not the God that I worship. And at the end of the day, I do think we need to struggle to look for each other's humanity. You know, when Representative Gamrat lost her RNC position, her race for the RNC representative, I wasn't upset per se, but, you know, I do feel bad for on a human connection that she, you know, wasn't successful in what she wanted to do. And so I've always tried to maintain an open, honest line of communication with them. We find lots of other things that we can talk about where we agree on. And I think for me at the end of the day, I struggled always to treat people the way you'd want to be treated. So even in the midst of this, even when they say things that really hurt me personally, I try to make sure that, you know, we're looking for the best in people, because I hope that when other folks disagree with me politically, or they think that I'm doing something that offends them, that they try to take it in the best way possible. And if we see each other's humanity, I think we always are going to do better in politics and as people.
So it appears that nothing will get done about Michigan's roads until after Labor Day at the earliest, because the legislature adjourned last week without any sort of a deal. There seems to be now a sort of a debate going on about how much is going to be new revenue, how much is going to be taken from other areas of the budget. How much are you willing to look at pulling something from another area of the budget and putting it to roads? And are there places that you would look and say, yes, we could take funds from that pot and use it for infrastructure?
I'm absolutely willing to look at sort of redistributing general fund dollars or other parts of the budget. But I want to be really clear about this. We can't just budget on the assumption that we're going to always have more money. That's a fallacy that has been proven ineffective time and time again. I've only been in office since January, and we've already gone through a round of budget cuts. Remember, and that was on the heels of Governor Snyder telling us there's going to be a $1 billion surplus. All of a sudden, the first thing that we have to do in January is find a way to cut literally hundreds of millions of dollars, because it turns out that money wasn't there.
And this goes back to the business tax credits, which had been promised and then had to get paid out because people were coming to claim them.
Absolutely. And it also then looks at the general business environment of the state. You know, we have long-term trends about property values and how much money is being moved online versus in our brick and mortar stores. I mean, there's a whole host of factors. So if we really want to budget for a long-term solution, we really should be thinking about how do we pay for it on the revenue side and then make smart pledges on the cut side to supplement that, to accelerate the rate of our growth on there. And the problem with the current plan is that it does not have nearly enough revenue, potential revenue, to pay for the roads that we need. And it requires then a set of cuts that ultimately people say will come from future revenue, but it's likely going to come to cuts to higher education or revenue sharing. And to say, well, that's not where we'd cut it in the future, it's a bit of again, erroneous, because we can't bind the hands of a future legislature. And anyone who does this work knows that that's constitutionally true. So we can say it all we want, and then a different group 2 years from now can make different choices than we would.
And they could be facing a series of external factors that you don't know about right now.
Exactly. So I'm even in the best or worst intentions, it'd be sort of like going to a restaurant and then ordering a bunch of food and saying the next person's going to definitely pick up the tab. You know, we wouldn't do that in for a restaurant, right? And we shouldn't do it for our state legislature. It has to be looking at the revenue side.
Okay, so if you're going to get new revenue, where should it come from? Should that be a higher gas tax, higher vehicle registration fees, or somewhere else that hasn't been talked about yet?
I think we can be creative about this. I mean, the first thing, and again, I know it's not politically popular, but I feel like we should just say the truth on this. We haven't raised the gas tax since 1997. So if we raise that tax, or if even if it just kept up with inflation, we would be in a much better position right now. The second thing, though, and so we should look there. The second thing is, I think there is a chance to look at some vehicle registration issues. And, you know, one thing that was being floated on Wednesday morning was a proposal that would say we need to increase vehicle registration fees, but we'd capture them back at the local levels. So we would then say the new money that we're raising here in Kalamazoo or in Berrien or Calhoun, wherever we're raising it from, would stay in that area, and it'd be up to the locals to decide how best to spend that. And that idea is really appealing to me, because it both addresses then, through a portion, the statewide needs of our transportation system and moves money back locally. The Democrats have also talked about other plans, whether that's some change to the corporate income tax structure or some of the energy recaptures, lots of different ways that we could help supplement some of this. And I think all those need to be on the table. But here's the bottom line. If we're not coming up with at least $1 billion a year in new revenue, and frankly, that number needs to be more like 1.2, 1.4, or as high as 2 billion, then we're not going to catch up or keep pace with the need of repairs. And I am tired of going into programs that we know will ultimately fail. And if we're going to raise taxes and only, let's say, get $600 million, and then have to come back and say, we raised your taxes and it wasn't enough to get the job done. That makes government look bad. It's setting us up for failure. No business would do that. So why would we subject that to taxpayers into the state of Michigan? It's foolish.
Okay. You say you need $1 billion in new revenue. I mean, but at the same time, you know, the roads are deteriorating. If you could only get $800 million and another $300 million from somewhere in the budget, can you live with that, knowing that at least it would fix some of what we have out there right now?
So our total number would be over $1 billion then. I mean, that's something I could work with. But here's what we know historically. Then when we talk about dedicating future general fund dollars, the two biggest chunks of that money are either going to come from corrections or higher education. And, you know, for too long, we've been cutting higher education. And my gut tells me that's what's going to get cut again. And I am tired of us passing the buck to students who need higher education, either a 2 or 4 year degree, to make it into the middle class. And what we're doing is saying that we're going to keep raising their tuition because we're not willing to fund our state's priorities like roads. That is not sustainable. The students are graduating with more and more debt, and it's bad for our communities, and it's bad for students, it's bad for young families. Let's turn it around.
You have proposed legislation that would create an independent redistricting commission to draw the boundaries for congressional districts as well as state house and senate. The idea here, by people who have proposed this in the past, is you take as much of the politics as possible out of the process of drawing these lines. How much can you eliminate politics from what is, after all, a very political question?
You're never going to be able to remove politics entirely. But the system that we're proposed, and we're open to additional feedback to change, would look at creating a system that combines a little bit of qualified folks, citizens being participating in this with a random chance so we can't stack the deck, and then ultimately putting some criteria in place that say you can't look to, you know, see where the incumbents live and those sort of things. I mean, here's the thing I think is interesting about this concept of nonpartisan redistricting. We're the only democracy in the world that lets the people who will benefit from drawing the lines do the drawing. And I've said this for a long time, and I think a lot of people get it. When you combine high amounts of money in politics with very short term limits that empower lobbyists more than people, and then you gerrymander those districts, so create a process. I'll be fair, that says create a process that lets the people who benefit from the drawing draw the lines. You've set up a recipe for bad government. We need to start turning that back around, and you know, a nonpartisan independent redistricting commission that should favor neither Democrats nor Republicans is a step in the right direction, even if it won't solve all the problems that are making it so we're not getting the job done right now.
You won your election to the state house with 70% of the vote, something like that.
Yep.
But I look at Kalamazoo and I just wonder how you would divide it up anyway that would somehow make it competitive. I mean, the city of Kalamazoo is very solidly Democratic. And one of the things you do like or try to do generally with drawing districts is to keep communities together, not split up cities 8 different ways to get different districts. I guess, you know, it gets back to that question that people have talked about, the big sort, that people tend to go and live in areas with people who think like they do. And, you know, should a redistricting commission look seriously at that and try to find ways to spread out the voters, even if it does mean that maybe not all the voters in the city of Kalamazoo would be in the same state house district?
The proposal that I've pushed for, that's a reintroduction of former Representative Sean McCann's work and working with Jeremy Moss, Representative Moss. You know, altogether, we're saying there should be a set of criteria that looks at things like keeping geographic units intact, keeping municipalities intact. And, you know, this doesn't deny the fact that there are Democratic areas of the state and Republican areas of state. And frankly, they should be represented by people that share their values. The overall question, though, is when you start looking at some of these districts, like let's look around the city of Grand Rapids, and there's a crescent moon that's shaping around the city of Grand Rapids. You see districts shaped like crosses or spirals. And you have to, it begs the question, why are those communities put intact, right? And so, you know, I think this is one of those things where a lot of people are saying, when you go look at the map, something doesn't look right here. And for Kalamazoo, it may mean that we still have a Democratic, the 60th seat may stay solidly Democratic, or who knows, maybe that the independent commission would draw it up in some slightly different way. The point is, shouldn't that be up to an independent, nonpartisan group to decide, not legislators who are going to benefit from the decision?
Realistically, do you think that if this is going to happen, it's going to end up being through the ballot process, through people collecting petition signatures to put it before voters?
That is definitely one opportunity. I haven't seen how that's working out yet, so I haven't seen any language that may or may not be for voters. I'd want to compare it to what we've already proposed. Ultimately,
but I guess my question is, do you expect this to get any real traction in a Republican-dominated legislature right now?
Well, I would hope Representative Lyons, who is the chair of the committee, would at least have a hearing on it. And I've actually really enjoyed working with her across the aisle. And so, you know, it's one of those things. She's in the past suggested that we take a look at multiple ideas and have a hearing so that way we can inform and educate ourselves. I would hope that we'd have a hearing on this. And if folks want to contact her office, that would be great. Again, you know, we're House Joint Resolution AA and House Bill 4800 and ask for a hearing on them.
Let me ask you about LGBT issues. You're among the sponsors of legislation to remove the exception which was signed into law for religious-based adoption agencies so they don't have to work with same-sex couples. Of course, that came right on the heels of the Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage. Again, let me ask about getting traction. Is there any movement on this legislation? Is it even getting hearings in the House or Senate?
We just reintroduced the bills, and I know that Senator Kinesick is going to be introducing a similar version in the Senate. You know, the purpose of this was to say, in light of the Supreme Court ruling, how do we make sure that otherwise qualified families aren't being discriminated against? And then we do leave the provision in that says if they want that agencies could refuse service, but we won't support them with taxpayer dollars to do so. And for a lot of colleagues, I think this was a big sticking point. You know, letting organizations choose their membership or who they wish to serve. But our state constitution is actually pretty clear that we're not going to put one religious view above the other. I mean, that's in the Michigan Constitution. And so by using our taxpayer-funded dollars to support agencies that are picking and choosing who to serve based on their religious belief, it looks like we're calling into a constitutional question. Now, what we've proposed would get around that and say, you just can't use taxpayer dollars, but you can still operate how you wish in accordance to the tenets of your faith. It seems to me like a good compromise, and I hope that it gets taken up for consideration, and that's why it does have bipartisan support.
Prison reform. There's been a couple of reports out talking about Michigan reducing its prison population and saving taxpayers a good chunk of money to do it. Bridge has an interesting article last week where they asked the question, who should we cut loose first? And I guess if we are going to reduce the prison population, there does become the question of doing it smartly, not risking public safety. Do you have a group in mind of people who you think are currently being housed in Michigan prisons who we could let out and be relatively assured that we would not see some sort of spike in crime?
So this is one that I know that I need to do a little bit more study on, as does other folks, I'm sure. Ultimately, the data suggests that there's an older population that once you get, I can't remember the exact number, you know, it's like 60 or 55 or 70, it's somewhere in that age
range.
Your
crime committing years are generally behind you.
Exactly. So, you know, and there's actually a group of folks, depending on how long they served, what their original offense were, but because of their age, they may be, it may actually be better for the system if they are, you know, no longer in prison. So that's a group that we could take a look at. You know, some of the lowest hanging fruit, sort of the nonviolent drug offenders, those are in the system. And I think a lot of people would agree that those are folks that we could take a look at. Ultimately, you won't produce the savings, though, that really need to be examined if we're going to figure out how to both uphold law, justice, and, you know, find some way to make this a sustainable system moving forward.
Well, where do you think the savings are? I mean, if it's not necessarily in the low-hanging fruit, as you say.
I mean, ultimately, one thing that is, I think, just worth considering overall is taking a look at the length of our prison sentences. And one concept that I've heard a lot of people talk about is figuring out a way to parse out both aspects of the criminal justice system. I think a lot of people recognize there needs to be a punitive section of the reform system. People did things horrendously and they've hurt other folks. And so there needs to be a punitive section, that says, you know, you did something wrong and will be punished. The other part of that sentence, though, is supposed to be restorative. So how do we then really work with the victims and the survivors and the people that committed those crimes to make them whole again? And ultimately, what we've seen, I think, from some preliminary studies is that our sentences in the state of Michigan are typically 5 years longer on average than our surrounding states. So my question would be, what are we getting for having people sitting in prisons for 5 years longer? And that might be the place where we start taking a look at and saying, you know, is there a group there in some of the, in particularly some of these sentences that are just longer than other areas? And are we meeting both our punitive and restorative obligations? So we're making the, particularly the victims whole and put them front and center.
The Detroit News has an editorial today, which is Tuesday, calling for fewer school districts in Michigan. They're saying that we've had this decline in the school age population in the state, that it makes sense, in their words, to help districts merge or that those efforts should be encouraged. Would you agree with that?
I think anytime you can create efficiencies, that's a good thing. That said, I do want to make sure that one thing that we have in Michigan is that we have districts that are responsive to their local needs. So you're going to want to make sure you're taking a look at, are we meeting our local needs? Are we being responsive to the people we're supposed to serve? I would note that at the same time, we've had a decline in some enrollment. You know, we've had the proliferation of for-profit charter schools. You know, at the, so there's a lot of other factors that are taking a look at the changing enrollment in the state of Michigan. And I think the question, though, it shouldn't be necessarily just the dollars and cents, but ultimately, what's best for the kids we're serving, those students in the schools? How do we help them produce better outcomes? And you know, I think it's not just the way it's structured. I've been having some really interesting conversations about things like the long-term way that we pay for school debt and school construction. You know, we're one of the few states that do all of it through local bonding, and we don't have any sort of state grants. And it particularly that then is meaning we're not finding ways to incentivize building and capital improvement structure costs that could really help our students. There's great energy efficient and pro education opportunities through new building that we could be looking at, but we do it all on a debt based system. So we're literally now spending, you know, north of $140 million a year just servicing portions of the debt. And that's not even talking about local debt service, that's just at the state level. So I guess my point of all this is that it's not just how many districts we have, but we really should have a conversation about, is the structure that we built that is responsive to local needs still doing the job? And, you know, are the choices that we made 100 years ago in the way we finance our schools or pay for things really doing the job? Is Proposal A that passed 20 years ago still doing the job? And if the answer is no, sorta, I don't know, kinda, well, then let's have a full conversation about it instead of piecemealing everything out.
Somebody might point out, however, that if you look at what has gone on in trying to cobble together a long-term deal for roads, the idea of a full-blown overhaul of school finance seems even more politically difficult in a state where there's going to be some lawmakers who have small districts who are going to hold on tight. There's going to be places that have really nice facilities and they don't want to jeopardize that going forward or think that they'll be able to build something better 20 years from now. I mean, I guess I'm wondering just politically, is that a minefield that might even turn out to be more complicated than road funding?
Maybe. But if the, going back to the first part of this conversation, when I said, you know, part of the reason we have bad and non-responsive government is because we have very short term limits that empower lobbyists. We have very high campaign finance that makes it special interest money the most important. And then ultimately we have, you know, these districts that are cut in ways that then aren't as responsive as they should be. I mean, this is why we can't have those conversations. And I think when we were sold on these ideas a number of years ago, this isn't what people were expecting. And it's really hard to build the trust and the relationships to have the conversations that can make Michigan great again if we're not doing it in a way that recognizes that sometimes these conversations take time. We can't change a third of the legislature every 2 years. And, you know, we can't be more worried about raising thousands of dollars on the phone than we are about listening to people in our districts. But that's what the system does now.
Okay, so we know where you stand on an independent redistricting commission to address the districts in the state. Would you favor then eliminating term limits?
I signed both options that Representative McBroom, Republican from the 108th district, have proposed. One of them would make it so we have a bank of years, and that would give you like 16 years total that you can spend in the House or Senate, which will allow folks to get some seniority. And I've also had the one that eliminated term limits. There is a process that can change things. And ultimately, you know, we call those elections.
There is also something of a movement out there, though, that about maybe some horse trading here. Maybe we get rid of term limits, but we bring in a part-time legislature. What kind of trade would that be?
It's an interesting trade. And one that, again, I would say folks should be really careful about. You know, I grew up in South Dakota, and we had a legislature that convened for 7 or 8 weeks a year. And you know who gets to serve in that type of legislature? A bunch of folks that can afford to take 2 years off, of the year. And then, you know, they're too busy doing other things during the year, or they're retired to go serve their constituents. And so I would ask the question, would you run a $53 billion entity with just, maybe a couple months a year? And, what type of diversity do you want in the legislature? And it's hard to do that if the only occupations are either rich business person or retiree. I don't think that's as responsive as it could be.
State Representative John Hoadley, as always, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
John Hoadley is a Democrat. He represents Kalamazoo and the surrounding townships in the 60th State House District. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.